Part 2. Fast Track. Learning carries within itself certain dangers, because out of necessity one has to learn from one's enemies. Leon Trotsky. Training Mission. Near Boston. Timeline 4. May 2020. 2 months after her abortive kidnapping, Rita was allowed a weekend trip home to visit her family. In fact, she was urged to do so.
"Email and Facebook aren't enough," explained her supervisor,
an affable African-American named Patrick O'Neill, who'd worked surveillance operations when he was in the FBI.
"If you vanish off the face of the earth for weeks, then send them vaguely reassuring messages, your parents will worry that you've been abducted. It's entirely natural. But you've been through basic orientation and briefing now, and it'll make life a lot easier for us and for them if you go home and explain what's happened."
"Easier for you?" Rita asked dubiously. Patrick shrugged.
"Your grandpa's been rattling the bars. Your father's even talking about hiring a private eye just to shut him up. It's not going to help anybody if they waste money on a wild goose chase. And we figure they'll calm right down if they get a chance to see you in person. Regularly, even. So we've got a cover package for you that should hold up for a weekend, and we can work it into your training schedule. Think of it as a field exercise. We'll recycle the same cover when you go to Quantico for the National Academy course, so it'll help you bed in."
"Okay." Rita resisted the urge to jump up and down. 8 weeks of grueling exercise and 6-hour classroom days at the TSA's off-world Camp Graceland Training Center had begun to blur into a hellish cross between the Girl Scouts, college, and a prison. Camp Graceland was a boot camp for spies. The teacher-student ratio was nearly 1-to-1, and except for her direct supervisor, Patrick, everybody knew her by a false name. They had started with medical tests, drug tests, epigenetic methylation scans, the usual, then rushed her through a bunch of interviews and security checks, some while being monitored by a polygraph, others with her head stuck in an fMRI scanner. She still remembered the very serious security officer's expression as he'd asked if she was now or ever had been a communist. He'd been a sight. The question was clearly the legacy of some paranoid congressional imposition on the national security apparat.
"No, but my grandpa Kurt used to be one, and I send him photographs of government buildings via dead letter drop,"
clearly wasn't on the list of acceptable answers. It had led to her explaining her geocaching hobby to him. And the idea that there was an entire subculture of folks who went on furtive internet-mediated treasure hunts for buried objects using GPS and old-school spy tradecraft seemed to have caused him deep personal distress. Luckily for her, eccentricity was not yet illegal, so she eventually passed the checks. The interviews and a swearing-in were followed by a week-long basic organizational orientation course, then a stripped-down version of the training that National Clandestine Service people got. The upcoming course at Quantico was more conventional. It was the law enforcement leadership course the FBI ran for other organizations. Clearly, someone upstairs thought it might help if she knew how to think like a senior cop. Or a senior counter-espionage officer.
"When do I go?"
"You've got 2 more weeks on this segment," said Patrick. "We'll use the final week to work up your cover and establish operating procedures. Then you get to go on leave on Friday using your cover while traveling. You don't need to use the cover while you're with your folks, but resume on Monday when you travel to Quantico."
"Huh." She paused. "How much can I tell them? How much do you want me to hold back?"
Patrick checked a file on his tablet.
"You can tell them you landed a job with DHS. That's not a problem. If they know anything about your, birth parents, you can hint that it's connected. But they don't need to know about Graceland, about anything that's happening here, or anything you've been told is classified or that you suspect is classified and somebody screwed up and forgot to tell you about. And if they don't already know about your birth mother's capability, they don't need to learn about it now. There's a cover story for them, a boring office job, and some stuff you periodically get asked about. If they conclude that we've roped you in so we can keep an eye on you, that's perfect because it's partly true.
Right. Rita paused. I don't like lying to my parents, she admitted. It went against every instinct of her upbringing. But then so did opening up and telling Patrick what she was thinking. It had taken weeks of work on both their parts to get to the point where it was possible. Rita was independent-minded, suspicious, and somewhat anti-authoritarian. She'd have been a complete washout for a regular DHS job. But a human intelligence agent, or HUMINT asset, as the organization referred to them, required an entirely different profile. It goes against the grain.
We don't want you to lie to them. People are mostly very bad at lying, and good at telling when folks they know are lying to them. What we want is for you to tell them the truth, but only the safe bits. This way you can calm them down and reassure them not to worry about you, and then you can stop worrying about them, which you have been doing to the point where if you keep doing it, it'll impair your ability to do your job.
He raised an eyebrow.
Did you think we hadn't noticed?
No.
Rita flushed. Kid, you're wound up tighter than a drum. We're training you for one of the most specialized and stressful missions. You'll do your job better if you're not looking over your shoulder the whole time worrying about your family. Anyway, we'll start on your cover briefing tomorrow. Right now, you're due to start the Intro to Crypto workshop with Melissa from No Such Agency in about 10 minutes. I'd get moving if I were you.
Near Phoenix. Timeline 2. May 2020.
Mom?
Rita! Where have you been?
Long story, Mom. Listen, is Dad around? Grandpa? What about River? Is he okay?
Yes, yes, everyone's all right. Are you?
I'm about 30 miles up the road, Mom, driving a rental. I can be with you in an hour?
Oh my, yes, come right over.
Listen, are you in trouble?
Not exactly, but I've got a new job and things are complicated.
Can it wait so I can tell everyone over dinner?
Oh, yes, yes, you're right. Come right on over.
Love you, Mom. Bye.
Love you, too.
Click.
Rita hunched over the steering wheel of the rental, breathing deeply for a minute, then slid her split personality phone away. It didn't seem real, exactly. There was a sheet of invisible glass between her and the world now, unreflecting, intangible, but a barrier nonetheless.
And I'm not Rita, I'm Anna, until I get home.
Anna Mittle, read the name on her Arizona driver's license, with an address in Phoenix, age 24, a physiotherapist. Not Rita Douglas, age 25, Boston resident and driver's license, former non-union actor turned DHS probationary employee, with payroll records pointing to a back office job, vetting frequent flyers for the streamlined secure boarding program.
It's a game, Patrick had explained during one of the briefing sessions.
Training doctrine called for the gamification of everything short of wet ops, assassination. Games were, after all, formalized play, and play was how young mammals acquired and then performed essential life skills.
Your objective is to minimize your threat surface when exposed to a hostile environment. In this case, all you need to do is flip between Rita and Anna. There'll be a different protocol if we ever send you overseas, but these are the basics. And practicing on your family is a great way to upskill yourself. Just remember not to show Anna's ID card or SIM personality to your folks, or Rita's to any hostiles, and you'll do fine.
The car did most of the driving for 30 miles, finally beeping for human supervision when it reached the main street leading to the subdivision
her family lived in. The suburbs were undergoing a mild renaissance, recovering from the gas price-induced real estate wilt of the noughties. Franz had followed a job out here, Emily joining him along with her brother River, another adoptee. They'd snapped up a McMansion in a not-too-decrepit area for cash and extended themselves on credit to adapt an adjacent house for Grandpa Kurt, on the not unreasonable theory that when Grandpa didn't need it anymore, they'd be able to turn a profit on it for the kids. Back when gas had been $4 a gallon, commuting from here would have been a real strain. But with gas at 80 cents, thanks to imports from other timelines, it was a different story. The neighborhood was rising. Only the unnatural green of the astroturfed front yards hinted at the real cost of living large. Rita didn't like Arizona. It was currently run by a Dominionist governor who rallied his followers with a dog whistle, with a creepy Save the Babies defense of marriage proposition on the ballot to amend the state constitution at the next election. But it was where her family had moved. If she wanted to see them, she could either visit Jesus Land or use her phone camera. Rita pulled in behind a familiar SUV and parked. She swapped her ID cards again, reset her phone, and hauled out her carry-on. She walked up to the front door, smiling and waving at the camera. "Hi, Mom, it's me." The door clicked open.
"Rita!" Emily hugged her. "We've been so worried. Where have you been? Come in, let's shut the door."
It was almost 100 Fahrenheit outside, 75 indoors.
"Long story."
Rita dropped her bag in the hallway.
"Ancient history came looking for me, but I'm okay. Coffee first. Your room's waiting for you. I left the bedding off to air, but it's same as always. River's in class, but he'll probably be home by 6. Gramps? He's out, as usual, at this time of day. He volunteers at a Goodwill shop. Not Goodwill, a different charity, but you know what I mean."
Emily retreated toward the kitchen. Rita followed. She hadn't seen her mom in 3 months. There was more gray in her hair, and her cheeks seemed to sag more than 90 days could account for.
"Don't worry, by the way. I've finished all my work today. I was thinking about cooking up a feast for tonight, seeing we're a full family."
She smiled.
"Want to help me shop for food?" "Oh, Mom." "Yes, but you don't have to..." "The hell I don't! First you're off to Seattle on that hand-to-mouth thing, then you disappear for a couple of days, and the next I hear is some horrible news. An attempted abduction? And we're visited by a couple of men in black who tell us everything is going to be fine, then you barely write, much less call, for weeks and weeks?"
Her mother's shoulders were shaking. Rita stared for a moment, then closed the gap and hugged her.
"Listen, it's going to be all right, but..."
She hesitated.
"I'm going to have to ask you about my, birth mother. Everything you know about the... before you adopted me."
"Oh, hun," Emily sniffed. "I was hoping you wouldn't ask me that. Or it could wait for another few years until everything was a bit calmer."
Calm. Only her mother would use that word to talk about the biggest national trauma of the century.
"Mom, listen, it's okay. They, gave me a job. I think so they can keep an eye on me. The DHS, I mean. It's just that I need to know everything you know. For my own safety?"
She heard a whine threatening to climb into her voice, made herself stop talking.
"I get that. Thing is, hun, we didn't know anything. No, that's not quite right. I mean, yes, Kurt suspected something, a bit. But we didn't put two and two together until after 7/16. We thought it was just the usual sort of problem, that your birth mother had just been unlucky and you could live a normal life. It wasn't until after 7/16 and the visit from the FBI that we realized who she must have been."
Rita let go and took a step back.
"Well, I mean, I never met her.
It mostly went through the lawyers. But her mother, your grandmother, I guess, Kurt knew her. And he introduced us this one time, and she seemed perfectly nice.
Wait. Rita shook her head. It was too much to assimilate quickly.
A grandmother? You mean I've got a grandmother?
Maybe, maybe not.
Her mom shrugged uncomfortably.
She was on crutches, Rita. She had MS. A few years later, Kurt said he'd seen her and she was in a wheelchair. Then she disappeared. This would have been, late 2002 or early 2003, a while before 716. Months, maybe a year.
She disappeared? How come?
I don't know. Ask your grandfather. He might know some more.
But Rita, you've got to understand. We didn't know. Nobody knew about the World Walker thing, or the bombs. That all happened years later, and we only figured it out when the FBI came and interviewed us after 716. All we knew was that this nice lady, a friend of Kurt's, whose daughter had got in trouble at college, was looking for adopters. And Franz and I were never going to have babies ourselves.
Oh, Mom.
The coffee maker began to hiss, then clicked loudly. Rita moved instinctively toward the cupboard with the mugs. It was something to occupy her hands while her brain tried to catch up.
I hope you don't think I blame you for any of it.
No, Mom, I don't. Fat free or half and half? I'm on fat free again.
I'm sorry. I thought you were better off out of it, not knowing.
It wasn't your fault.
I can't believe your birth mother had anything to do with it, or her mother, for that matter. I honestly thought it was all in the past and there was nothing to worry about anymore. Until they came and started asking us questions about you a couple of months ago.
Mom, here's your coffee.
Rita tried to conceal her disquiet. Of course they'd have visited Emily and Franz as part of her background check. Why wouldn't they?
Thank you, dear.
With a visible shudder, Emily pulled herself together.
Then I need to go shopping. Come with me and you can catch up on all the gossip.
That evening, after an exhausting family dinner, almost a mini Thanksgiving, with a distinct subtext of gratitude for Rita's delivery from whatever durance vial she had been consigned to by the DHS, Rita walked home with her grandfather, Kurt. It wasn't much of a walk, but it put some distance between Rita and Emily's hand-wringing, Franz's quiet concern, and River's brattish teenage brother act.
"Come in, come in," Kurt mumbled as he held the front door open for her. "Out of the heat."
It was hot in Kurt's abode, too. He kept the upper floor closed off, sleeping in the downstairs den next to the living room and venturing up top, only to shower. But it was cooler than the desert evening outside, and it was quiet, with only her usually taciturn grandfather for company.
"You must tell me the truth," Kurt said. "Over a beer."
It came out like an order, a throwback to his youth.
"I'd rather not."
Kurt snorted, then pulled out his phone. He placed it inside a fleecy bedroom slipper on the boot rack by the front door, raised an eyebrow, and offered the other slipper to Rita. After a moment's hesitation, she copied him. Kurt led her through the front hall to the kitchen and closed the connecting door. The refrigerator was well stocked with imports that reminded Kurt of home.
Schöfferhofer, Weihenstephaner, Meisel's Weisse,
and a six-pack of Miller Ice for visitors. He ate most evenings with Franz and Emily. After Greta had died, he'd retreated into quiet introspection, his son and daughter-in-law and grandchildren the focus of his remaining social life. Rita had been worried by his withdrawal, but the news that he'd taken a volunteer job sounded hopeful. Kurt pulled two bottles from the fridge, popped their caps, and carefully poured them into a pair of ceramic steins.
"Drink," he told her. "I know you didn't tell your parents everything. Nobody ever does. Come into the living room and unwind. I'll tell you a story."
"What do you mean?"
Rita followed Kurt into the living room.
It was furnished mostly in shades of brown and orange, leavened by outbreaks of ancient black leather, like a washed-up 70s bachelor pad, and it smelt faintly of stale cigarettes. Kurt had been giving up tobacco for as long as she could remember. He walked stiffly, wincing slightly. His hips were hurting again.
"When I was a young man, fresh out of the Volksarmee, let me tell you, it was a different world. There were 17 million of us in East Germany, and over 100,000 secret police in the Stasi. Think of it. 2.5 times as many secret police per person as there are ordinary cops in America. And ordinary Vorpo, Volkspolizei, on top. But that's not all. The Stasi used informers. 500,000 of them. Maybe 2 million irregular informers. 1 in 8 people were snitches. You couldn't drink at a bar without drinking with a snitch. So we drank at home. Prost.
He raised his stein. Hesitantly, Rita raised hers in return. They'd been doing this since she was 14, although he'd had the sense to start her on the alcohol frei. This wasn't Germany, after all.
Of course, these days, they don't need informers. Your phone does it for you. So, no need for nice hair, Staatssicherheit, to buy you a beer, make you feel good, and offer you the life of adventure and secrecy and free goodies in return for playing spy on my neighbor.
Her grandfather raised an eyebrow at her.
That's not what happened to you, is it?
She shook her head.
Good. When they asked me to spy for them, I was your age. I was young and foolish, but not that foolish. I was listening to Feindsender and reading stuff I really shouldn't be caught with when I was in the factory. So maybe they thought, I was a young tearaway but not so crazy I didn't fit in during my time in the army, so they could use me. Tell me to go to music clubs and listen to people who talk too much, to people they really should not trust. And you know, in those days, if you do as they tell you and tell stories, you maybe get ahead. Get promoted faster. That sort of thing.
They asked you? Rita goggled at him.
Yes, the Stasi asked me.
Kurt's face crinkled into a grin.
Them asking me made me ask some questions of myself, I can tell you. I didn't much like the answers, but as we used to say, the opposite of well done is well meant. I devised a way out. And the next evening I went to my local bar and got drunk. I told anybody who listened how the Stasi asked me to spy for them, and they never asked me again.
He took a gulp of wheat beer and sighed happily.
I'm not an informer, Rita said hesitantly. But they made me a job offer. I wasn't allowed to refuse it.
So far, so good.
I think they want to keep an eye on me. A close eye.
They can arrest you, Kurt said dismissively. Why do you think they want you?
Rita sat down on the edge of the sofa opposite Kurt's recliner.
Tell me about my birth mother.
I never met her, Kurt sniffed. Her mother, though. I knew her kind. An illegal living under a false identity. I guessed she was on the run. Had been involved with the Weather Underground or something like that. Wanted by the FBI. Anyway, she did not fit in on her own. Turned up in Boston and hooked up with a Jewish bookstore clerk, man called Beckstein. That was in 72, 73. I met her later in 91 through your grandmother. She was with a group of counterculture dissidents, optimists who didn't believe it was just the same shit on either side of the wall. Anyway, in 94, her daughter gets in trouble at med school, has to choose career or kinder, and Mrs. Beckstein asks me, "Your fine daughter-in-law and her fertility problem, does she still want a baby?"
Rita licked her lips. Mom's problem was that early?
Problem was the family euphemism for uterine cancer. The OBGYN had spotted it soon enough that the surgery was a complete success, but it had put an end to Emily's baby-making plans before she even got started.
Yes, Kurt nodded. So we talk it over, Mrs. Beckstein, and your mother and me and your father, and we agree to work it out, which is where you come from.
Tell me about Mrs. Beckstein.
Why?
He looked at her sharply.
What do you know about her?
Rita licked her suddenly dry lips. She's one of the World Walkers.
Right.
Kurt nodded. No attempt at dissembling. You knew, she thought.
The FBI came calling when you were 8. You don't remember, of course. They are not idiots to arrest small children.
But you, aren't you
appalled? That she's one of the people who blew up the White House? Rita, she was a runaway, a refusenik, one who walked away taking her daughter. You might as well blame me for the shootings at the Berlin Wall.
Kurt sat up straighter.
You listen to me, girl. You must not be ashamed of her. All groups have dissidents. All groups have those who reject them, change their names. Just like me, your grandfather Douglas. A good American name, no? I changed my name because even after I come over here, I do not want to make it easy for the GDR embassy to write to me. Now you tell me, what do the DHS really want with you?
Rita froze. I'm not supposed to tell you. I'm supposed to spin a story about how they were following up records and ran across my birth mother and offered me an office job where they can keep an eye on me in case the World Walkers come looking for me.
Kurt nodded encouragement. Yes?
Well, she licked her lips again, then abruptly took a mouthful of beer and put her stein down on the coffee table. The World Walkers came looking. Kidnapped me and stuffed me in my car trunk. Luckily the DHS were there and... Kurt was shaking his head. What?
Nothing. Go on.
I'm not a World Walker, she said, crossing her arms defensively. But they said the World Walkers appear to think... She trailed off.
Rita.
Kurt peered at his stein, then shook his head.
They always lie to you. Always. It's the first law of Staatssicherheit. The American Heimatschutzministerium is no different from the Stasi in the old days, except they have more money.
If you think it's so bad, why did you come here? She demanded, hating her words the moment she heard them.
Because,
for a moment he looked every one of his 77 years,
we knew our government was lying to us about our glorious socialist system. So we thought they were lying about the evils of capitalism, too. Also, everything here was good at first. It was only later.
He looked wistful or frustrated or both.
It was only after the failure of actually existing socialism to deliver the goods that we learned they'd been telling the truth some of the time, whenever it was convenient for them, and that the other side had been lying too whenever it was convenient for them. The best kind of lie is one that is a selective version of the truth, leaving out the messy, sticky, embarrassing bits. They all lie. The difficult part is telling when they aren't. And even so, many things are still better here.
He looked around, miming confusion, at the shag pile carpet and the 72-inch TV.
Big houses, big cars, big stakes, big government. It's true. Capitalism delivers the goods. It also delivers big police. The Internet Rasterfahndung.
He sighed.
They don't talk about that, though, any more than the communists liked to admit that their less unequal society was also poorer. For people so obsessed with freedom, they have a surprising number of police. But this is my home now, and I'm too old to start over. And besides, Germany is not so different today. Unless you are a woman of a certain type, of course, in which case perhaps Germany is more welcoming."
He gave Rita a knowing look, then picked up his stein and took another mouthful. Chugging the German import wheat beers in one gulp was inadvisable, as Rita had discovered the hard way some years ago.
"Remember this, granddaughter. They lie to you, but you can learn the truth if you look for the silence between the lies."
He paused for a moment.
"If you were useless to them, they would ignore you. If you were a threat to them, they would put you in prison. So they must think you are useful to them."
"I told you the world walkers tried to—" He cut her off with a gesture.
"This happened right after the DHS spoke to you? How convenient.
But they tried to kidnap me."
"Did you see them world walk?"
"No."
"Then how do you know they were world walkers?"
"But one of them was shot by the police. I saw it happen."
"So?"
Kurt snorted.
"A local lowlife is hired to abduct a woman. Who cares what happens to him?"
"You're saying the DHS kidnapped me? And told me it was world walkers? Why?" She was mustering her objections one by one, and Kurt was knocking them down just as she'd been afraid he would. He shrugged.
"I don't know that that happened. And you don't know that it didn't. Do you? It could be a way of making you say yes to their job offer, couldn't it? Like the beer in that bar in Dresden that time and the promises of adventure to a young man. Do you know why they want you?"
Rita shook her head, acutely aware she did so of a growing sense of self-betrayal. "I have no idea," she lied. For in truth, she did know. But she couldn't tell Kurt. They planned to make a world walker of me in a room that might be wired. "I need to find out, though, don't I?"
"Yes, you do. They will, of course, have told you not to discuss this matter with anyone, especially your grandfather. So we have not had this conversation,"
Kurt announced to the room. He emptied his stein.
"Well, that's it for me for this evening," he said thoughtfully.
Rita set her own tankard down. It was still a quarter full. "I'd better get back home."
"You do that."
Was that disappointment in his voice, or just her guilty imagination? "I'll see myself out," she said.
"Of course."
As she walked to the door, he added,
"If you ever decide to tell me the rest of your story, I'll be here. I'll trade you for more about your third grandmother."
He wasn't disappointed. He was amused. But of course, he could read her like a book. Rita slammed the door on her way out and stomped back to her parents' house in a foul mood. They, at least, seemed to believe what she told them. But then they'd never played footsie with the Stasi. Whereas Grandpa Kurt had taught her everything she knew. On Saturday, Rita went to a ball game with Dad and River. On Sunday morning, she declined an invitation to go to church with her mom. Instead, she went for a long walk with her fat phone and a geocaching website for company. She found and logged two caches, collected a travel bug from one of them. "Help me get to New Zealand," it declared. Having started in Anchorage, she figured a ride to Maryland wouldn't hurt. Reported another cache as muggled, removed by non-cachers, and went home. In the afternoon, she hung out with Kurt at the thrift store he volunteered at, which was hosting some kind of local artists' event in support of their mission. She didn't apologize for lying to him, and he didn't let her off the hook. But by tacit assent, they avoided the subject and instead kept the conversation to anodyne matters like the game, a dumb sitcom, and Dad's work. It kicked the ball down the road away, but it wasn't like she had to tell Kurt anything, was it? The art display struck her as naive and a bit tacky, but the thrift store had a bunch of other stuff, ranging from ancient laptops and tablets through souvenirs and a couple of bookcases stuffed with musty-smelling old paper books. Kurt paused beside one, ran his hand along a shelf, then presented her with a dog-eared paperback, its cover missing.
"You should read this," he said, handing it to her.
Rita held it between finger and thumb. "It's probably moldy," she said, nose wrinkling. "Why should I? What's so special about..." She checked the title page. "The Grasshopper Lies Heavy by,
"It's out of print. You won't find it on Amazon," said Kurt. "Which is odd because the author also wrote Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? The book behind Blade Runner. You have seen Blade Runner?"
He sighed when she shook her head.
"Read this anyway. It is an excellent allegory for the totalitarian mind, and also nobody can examine your online annotations or page-turning habits on paper."
"Gramps, you're being paranoid. Anyway, it can't be any good if it's gone out of print, can it?" Kurt merely turned away, his sardonic smile fading. Stung, Rita hovered for a moment, then took the yellowing block of paper to the front desk.
"Oh, just take it," Allie the clerk told her. "They've been clogging up the back for years. Nobody buys those things anymore."
After lunch, Rita loaded up her rental and said her goodbyes, hugging Mom and Dad and promising to write more often. Kurt saw her out to the car.
"Your birth mother's mother was a good woman," he said gravely. "Not one of the mad bombers. Remember that. Remember, too, you may work for the Stasi, but you do not need to be of the Stasi."
"Oh, Gramps," Rita shook her head. "Spare me the riddles."
She hugged him, but his attention seemed to be focused elsewhere, inward. So she closed her car door and became Anna Mittle again, for the drive back to the airport and the DHS highway checkpoint that nearly made her miss her flight. Camp Graceland, Timeline 4, Quantico, Timeline 2, May to July 2020. The next 10 weeks passed too fast for Rita to write to her folks, let alone take another weekend off work. The National Academy course was physically exhausting. While the Department of Homeland Security trainers at Camp Graceland had put her in the gym daily and begun working on her self-defense, most of the people attending the FBI course had military or police backgrounds, and everyone was expected to keep up. It was also mentally grueling, if not demoralizing. Some of her classmates had antediluvian attitudes toward women and people of Indian appearance, especially slightly built women of Indian appearance. It wasn't what they said to her exactly, but what they didn't say. She was on her own, without any of the peer support her classmates gave each other. There were lectures on law, behavioral science, forensics, and terrorism and terrorist mindsets. The stuff about leadership development made her head spin. Rita did not do well in these classes, especially the areas that emphasized policing skills.
"Not to worry about it," Patrick told her when he visited during week 3. "You're not going to be a cop. And even if you were, this stuff isn't about basic entry-level police work that you could expect to pick up. Just go with the flow and try to get a handle on how senior cops think. Because if you get to go out in the field, these are the people who'll be looking for you."
"I guess." Her eyes narrowed involuntarily. "But about that, I don't think my cover's holding."
"What? Has anyone accused you of being an imposter?"
"No, it's just that I can tell. They know I'm not really one of them. Some of them are playing along deliberately, and a couple have cut me dead, but I'm really not fitting in. Not sure whether I'm being given the cold shoulder because I'm not a typical cop," she said weakly.
Patrick's face hardened. "Any overt racism?"
No, but...
Has anybody called you out to your face?
No. I think it's more that they think I'm some kind of fake.
Then it's not a problem. Drop it.
O'Neill's tone was hard.
You're not expected to graduate top of your course, or even in the upper half. You're here to learn how detectives think, what makes them tick.
He thought for a moment.
We'll give you a second-level story. They already know you're DHS. If anyone challenges you, tell them the truth. You're undergoing deep cover training. The spin is that you'll be infiltrating activist groups as a long-term informer. If you don't mention the World Walkers, nobody's going to look for that angle. It's too weird. If they think the DHS is running spies into activist groups, that'll keep them happy.
He paused.
Racism is another thing. Official policy is zero tolerance, but you know what that's worth. If you get any trouble, call me and I'll get the colonel to drop his hammer on them. That is all.
What's...
Rita paused.
Yeah, I can do that.
Pretend to be exactly what I am. Tell Patrick if I get any of the other shit. Maybe they're not all assholes. Maybe that's why I got a non-Anglo supervisor.
Just don't volunteer any information unless you're directly challenged and you'll be fine.
Apart from the bruises and the marine assault course they expect me to pass.
Patrick snorted.
As it happened, nobody challenged Rita to her face. So after another week, she deliberately slipped some tells into her classwork, showing more interest than was strictly necessary in the law surrounding undercover informers, or in evasion techniques used by terrorists. After that, a couple of the guys who had been avoiding her started to nod in passing. There were even some brief guarded conversations in the canteen. They thought they had her pigeonholed. It made life a little more bearable, which she came to appreciate as the physical regime and long classroom hours ground down on her. It didn't break the ice all around. For some people, her skin would always mark her out as other. But it wasn't only her skin that was the problem. Simple racism would have been stamped on hard by the instructors. By week 6, she was coming to suspect that the real problem was in her head. Rita was lonely, an introvert exposed to an extrovert culture. She could fake it in the classroom and exercises by putting on a front, just like she could act on stage. But the continual effort over a period of weeks left her scant energy for socializing in the evenings, nor was the prospect of barroom bonding with sheriffs from small towns and lieutenants from big city forces remotely appealing to her. The cultural chasm she perceived when she looked at her classmates was dizzying. They'd chosen a career in law enforcement. She was something else, so different that she felt like a fraud, not through any kind of criminal inclination, but because where they saw things in red and blue, she saw an infinite range of purples. The graduate-level coursework she could focus on, the fitness regime was a weak point, but if she failed at anything, it was the networking and team-building. Finally, after 10 weeks, the ordeal was over. She said her abbreviated goodbyes to classmates who had remained strangers throughout, and slunk back to Camp Graceland with her tail between her legs.
"Good luck with your Mission Impossible assignment wherever they send you," said Martina, her course director, a grizzled FBI senior agent turned teacher. "You didn't fool anybody, by the way," she added with a smile. "But we don't mind. I just hope you got whatever your handlers sent you here for."